Welcome to Nature Now, an original production by KPTZ volunteers. Nature Now is a program of information and insights about the natural history of our region. We welcome observations and suggestions from our listeners, care of Nature Now at kptz.org.
Hello, this is Deborah on Kelso, host of this edition of Nature Now from mid-July. This week we are very happy to have for you part two of a field trip that we recorded back in mid-May, led by our guest Dr. Fred Sharp. We met on the beach at Fort Warden State Park and spoke about dune restoration and ecology, and were joined by our recorder and fellow beach lover Meg Amos. Before we start our beach walk, let's first hear the mystery sound of the week. Isn't this a cool sound? We'll play it again at the end of the program and tell you more about it. So when we left you last time, we had just started looking at some cool plants. We saw a beautiful little lupin, and as we were coming, we were hearing surf scoter wings.
Yeah, I think some beautiful surf scoters out there. They're migrating through right now. They winter here in pretty good numbers, and they do that kind of funny steaming thing where they run across the water and you hear that funny little as they're taking off. Welcome, birds, and you'll be leaving soon, going north and inland to breed.
Yeah, well, what a treat. And we've got a different kind of lupin here.
Yeah, this very large tree lupin. Tree lupin is a species of the dunes of California and Central Oregon, but it has been introduced into this area, and it's kind of one of those ones it's kind of like the California poppy, and I guess Californians in general. You know, like many of us, we're adventive, we're visitors, and we're living here, and we're here to stay, and so it hasn't necessarily been a big target for removal. It's beautiful, and it's not overly invasive, and it has beautiful, big, yellow blossoms that are just coming on right now, so hi, tree lupin.
So in this grass, is this more the cheatgrass?
Yeah, here we're in a little bit more of a wetter site. We're kind of in a bit of a swale down between the dunes, and so we see the cheatgrass is growing up to about a foot and a half now. There's another roadside ruffian here that's related to the cheatgrass. It's called ripgut grass. And so we'll leave what it is to your own imagination. But again, as you rub your fingers along it, you can feel these amazing little sticky little barbs.
So it's easily transported animal hair and people's socks.
Yeah, so it's another one of these ones that grows pretty early in the year and gets down to its roots deep and usurping the moisture that makes it challenging for some of our native grasses. But again, we see some of these dune restoration areas where it's kind of been cleared back.
Well, let's take a wander along this path that's well-defined, and part of it is cordoned off so that clearly people know where they should walk.
Here's one of my favorite plants right over here. This is called wormwood, or it's one of our soft sages. And it's really cool. It's kind of related to the sage's brushes of eastern Washington. There's several species that we get out on the dunes, and it's actually kind of cool.
It's kind of like a succulent, too.
Yeah, it is. Everything has kind of more of a succulent feel on a wet spring like this. But this is really cool because this shows kind of our affinities to the soft sage communities down in Baja California. And it's kind of a cool place for dunes in that dunes tend to be relatively arid and kind of tough places for plants to grow because it's sandy soils, water percolates down through very rapidly. Of course, we are in somewhat of a Mediterranean climate here to begin with, wet winters and dry summers, plus we're in the rain shadow of the Olympic Mountains, and so we get these fabulous soft sages with wormwoods and mugworts growing along our beaches here. And now we can hear the killdeers chirping off in the background. And we've also got some yarrow here. We've got our Puget gumweed growing. So yeah, nice. Oh, and here's our silver burrweed, another nice native that grows in this area. And again, we see the finely divided vegetation, sort of fine silvery hairs on the underside. These have sort of rather modest little blossoms that don't necessarily produce a lot of showy flowers, but another very distinctive low-growing member of our dune plant community.
Great. Well, we've moved about 5 feet. You know, it's a typical botanist walk, which suits us just fine.
Oh, here's a beauty right over here.
Mm. Oh,
look at
wow.
This glory. Glorious. This is a beautiful little beech pea here. Mm. It's got awesome two-colored blossoms. Beautiful. It's your typical pea blossom.
Almost a magenta. I mean, it's really a bright.
Yes, it's glorious.
Purple.
It's got the bright purple magenta banner with a white keel and these two white wings. Again, we're back to our finely dissected vegetation, silvery vegetation, but it's spectacular blooms right now. We've also got some of these fun little micro succulents. If you look, get down on your hands and knees and look very carefully.
Oh, look at those. They look like a meterwort. They look like a...
Miterwort?
Yeah.
Meterwort? Yeah, they kind of do. These are kind of related to miner's lettuce and tiny little guy here growing in the perfoliate miner's lettuce. In a lot of them, these are the same ones that you may get growing in your yard or along your fence row, but out here in the dunes, they form these small little succulent heads to protect themselves from the aridity. So there's also a really cool blue-eyed Mary out here that's almost out of bloom, growing in the very open areas. And so, kind of a little miniature community out here.
Meg spotted the killdeer, and it's bobbing, and I bet you it's on a nest there. And we're seeing a lot more of the beech pea, and it has this gorgeous silvery soft, it's like a sage, the color and the texture of it, but it's in the pea family. It is a truly beautiful plant, and it's really prolific here. Mm-hmm. Look how well it's doing.
Yeah, it's so cool when you give plants a little space. You stop the trampling and the off-road vehicles and remove some of the exotic plants, and it's amazing what returns here. So hats off to the Friends of Fort Worden and the AmeriCorps volunteers and the many members of the Native Plant Society that had made this place just beautiful.
Yeah. So what's this, leathery leaves?
These leathery leaves are the yellow sand verbena.
Oh, yeah.
They're in the 4 o'clock family and have those beautiful little heads, about the size of a golf ball, actually, and a nice yellow golf ball with those little trumpet little blossoms. Gorgeous. This has a really large rootstock, and occasionally you'll find when a dune migrates away from the rest of the plants, you'll see these exposed. They almost look like a little baseball bat, just like these big deep rootstocks that help the plants store moisture during our long dry summers here in the Pacific Northwest. And this yellow sand verbena, it's pretty widespread. It's fairly common in our sandy areas. There's another one that's much rarer. It's called the pink sand verbena. And that one formerly was collected here in a few sites along the North Olympic Peninsula, but it sadly has disappeared. Mm-hmm. One of my colleagues, Ross Venisland, he works up in BC both for the province and for the federal government, for Parks Canada. And they've had a really big restoration program with the pink sand verbena. And we'd love to see it actually return to some of our shores. One of the problems with some of these rare plants that grow along our coastal areas, well, first the sea level rise. So as it moves up, it creates more coastal erosion. And another very odd problem related to our forestry practices is the size and nature of our beech logs along our coastal area has changed over the last century. There used to be a lot more very large diameter logs, you know, some of them like 8, 10, 15, even 20 feet in circumference. And with large root wads, when the trees would get eroded during floods along the hillsides, above the beaches or come down rivers, and these giant logs these root wads would allow them to hold the beach sands much better and almost act like sort of these protection features along the coastal areas. But now our logs are much smaller. And if you look at the beach logs here along the beach, you'll notice that many of them have cut ends now. Uh-huh. And so they're just basically kind of like telephone pole-sized logs that are much easier thrown around and acting like battering rams that push up onto the beaches.
You know, I never thought about that. Mm-hmm. That's a really good point. Yeah, instead of the logs serving as anchors, they're serving as tools
kind of
erosion.
Kind of like big naginatas or battering rams. And so that's one of the things that they've been doing up in the coastal areas of British Columbia in their sand ecosystem. Ross and his colleagues have been trying to secure some of these logs or bring in larger, you know, roughness elements or chunks of coarse woody debris to help stabilize the beaches so we can have our lovely pink sand verbena amongst our native flora.
Oh, that's great. So, and what is this with this dissected leaf, but also a succulent leaf?
This is sea rocket. Mm. This could either be the American or the European sea rocket. And these have really cool seeds. They have beautiful, beautiful pinkish, light pink blossoms right now. And the seeds themselves are kind of cool because they have this sort of spongy or corky appendages on them, which allows them to float. And they can withstand many of the plants along our coastal areas in these dunes. They have to be able to withstand high winds, shifting sands, and salt spray. And many of them produce seeds that are able to withstand immersion and floating within the sound areas here. And they float around, and that's how they do a lot of their dispersal.
Is this also a native?
Here's our fun little seeds. The American one is native, although I think it might be actually introduced from areas further south. And there's also the European sea rocket, which, like a lot of us, comes from distant shores. Oh, what's that out there? Something has just popped its nose up. Oh, it's a river otter. How cool is that?
Yes.
Just swimming along just offshore here. River otters can be told from the sea otter, which we have on our outer coast. It's got the long, somewhat flattened little tail that it also uses for a paddle. Well, that's a cute one. Looks like a little young one. Maybe he's looking for his tribe. And the really cool thing about these river otters is that they have this very bizarre connection to one of our native succulents that also grows in these beach areas, is our prickly pear cactus. Mm. And we actually don't have the prickly pear right here, but it grows just across the straits here. We're looking across the straits, across the leaden seas right now, out over to Whidbey Island and Partridge Point. And there are some big patches of cactus over there. We've also got some cactus growing on some of the bluffs here on the Quimper Peninsula on just above Discovery Bay. And there's some really nice patches of this prickly pear cactus in Squim. And the crazy about the thing is that the cactus can do quite well in these low sandy areas. Also, we get some little bit about in Dungeness Spit. But there was a really cool study done a few years back by Terry D'Amico up in the San Juan Islands. And he documented all the habitats that the prickly pear cactus occurs. And what he found, there was a significant positive correlation of the distribution of the cactus and areas where you get the river otters coming ashore and denning and making their little roosting areas, their play areas, their sites where they come up on land to eat the fish or shellfish that they've captured. And so, like a good little cactus should, the prickly pear cactus in our area, it has a beautiful large blossoms, probably one of the largest blossoms on all the land, even in competition with the flowering dogwood for big, beautiful blossoms. But I've checked out, you know, dozens and dozens of the seed pods that are left behind after the cactus blooms, and I've never found any viable seed. And so they appear to be one of these plants that has purely gone into asexual reproduction and get around just by, with their sharp spines, using animals as their primary dispersal agent.
So the pear just gets attached to the animal. They don't need to pass through the
That's
gut
right.
or anything.
Right.
They don't eat the cactus.
They don't eat the cactus, but the cactus can get stuck on the fur of deer and elk and coyotes and occasionally the unwary botanist. Ow! And So yeah, so it's a really cool relationship where it appears that it's a marine mammal that is an aquatic mammal that is the primary disperser agent for our beautiful little prickly pear cactus.
Oh, who would have thought?
Who'd have thumped it?
That's great.
How you doing out there? You got any prickly pears on you, little otter?
Well, we are here on the beach and we see what you were talking about, that there are no big logs.
Yeah, everybody's got a cut end, and when the waves pick up, these logs can fly around, right? And you can see them sometimes during storms getting pushed quite a ways inland. And so, you can probably see in some of these areas where there's both riverine estuaries and beach areas, will actually bring in large logs from other areas to help stabilize the coastal environment. Well, one of the real stars here along the beach is our beach wild rye, or commonly known as dune grass. And we have these beautiful big flowering heads right now. You can see the projecting stamens, and grasses are wind pollinated. So they don't need to put on any airs with big flowers or scents or colors. They just project the male pollen-bearing structures, the filaments and the stamens out of the plant, and things just blows around with the wind. And this is a really handsome native dune grass. It's kind of a semi-bunch grass glowing in clumps, but
it's tall. Yeah. I mean, it's like almost a couple feet tall, and it's gorgeous.
By the end of the growing season, it'll probably be almost over our heads. And as we look around at these dunes, we notice that a lot of the dunes are sort of asymmetrical kind of triangles, and you can see that the stabilized areas have these big tufts of the dune grass. So it's a very important native.
And this is the native dune grass. One of the targets of the conservation effort has been getting rid of the European dune grass, right? The Ammophila, that was originally put in to stabilize the dunes, but they put in a European dune grass instead of this beautiful native.
Exactly. And the European dune grass, it's, well, I guess like a lot of Europeans, they can kind of take over. And the introduced dune grass, it's just a really good competitor, and it just can really suppress, it becomes so abundant that it really suppresses the native flora. And especially where you have areas of blowing sands, the sands build up very heavily. And when it gets blowing sand on it, it just grows like crazy and sends out more rootlets and more suckers and more runners. And pretty soon you get almost these pure stands of dune grasses. And so that's been one of the primary target species here, is the removal of, it's also called European sandbinder. And it's really amazing once you start to pull that out, you get our native plants come back. And on the outer coast, it's been really helpful for opening up the sites for species like certain insects, like tiger beetles that like open sandy substrates, and the snowy plover and the killdeers. So it's just a real treat to be able to look across these dunes. Well, in this area, I'm not seeing any introduced plants. It's all our natives. We got our beach pea, our lupin, our mugworts, and our dune grass. And again, hats off to the Friends of Fort Worden and AmeriCorps volunteers and the Native Plant Society.
Is it easy to tell the difference between the native dune grass and the European dune grass?
Yeah, it sure is. These heads here on the native dune grass, they tend to be bigger, taller. The blades of the grasses are much flatter and they're not rolled as much. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, so it's pretty, and these tend to be a little darker green in color. So it's pretty easy to tell them apart. And fortunately, one of the easy things about restoration activities on dune lands is that these sandy soils, it's pretty easy to pull stuff up. Mm-hmm. Things tend to come out pretty easily, and so that really helps with restoration. Well, we're here, we're along one of our trails, and we're dawdling up a little dune face where there's been a bit of a blowing sand and erosion, and here we're finding our yellow sand verbena again, and it's remarkable how big these roots are.
They're really corky. Well, no, it's almost like a sweet potato or something.
Yes. Nice, big, thick, great water storage organs. And you know, this, if you plant this, this will grow, right? This is like a fabulous sandy adaptation. These can float around and colonize new areas, and we can see where they're exposed to from the dune. We can see lots of roots and leaves coming out of these big, corky, almost like, it's almost as thick as a broomstick. Think of it, a broomstick sort of curving with lots of different little areas where roots and leaves can project from.
Oh, how cool.
Well, this area in Fort Gordon is recovering so nicely with its decades of conservation efforts and increase in public awareness. But what about our other dune environments on the Olympic Peninsula? Like, you've been working at Edith's Hook.
Well, we are really lucky in that we do have a lot of these, again, glacial materials and sandy glacial bluffs along much of the Quimper, Miller, and Squim Peninsula, and along our coastal areas. And so, you know, one of the longest sand spits in the Western Hemisphere is Dungeness Spit.
And luckily, that's in conservation
status. That's right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's had fantastic stewardship by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and they're doing a number of really cool restoration activities out there. And Dungeness Spit and Graveyard Spit, which is the south-facing projection of the sandy area along the spit, just out near the lighthouse, there's really broad areas for dune vegetation. And these isolated sites, they tend to have resisted invasion by exotic plants because they're more open and breezy areas, and it's just hard for exotic plants to get out there. So really nice intact flora out in Dungeness Spit. And a lot of those areas now have very limited or no public access, so it preserves these areas. Of course, there's no off-road vehicles out there. Mm-hmm. So yeah, really, really excellent floras. And then another one is Edith's Hook. Edith's Hook is the large, it's almost, almost like 3 miles, I guess, sand spit that projects out. And in some ways, sadly, Edith's Hook was sort of the fall guy for Dungeness Spit, in that it was an area that had a deeper harbor, more uniform harbor, and so it became sort of the most industrialized area on the North Olympic Peninsula. And it's kind of a sad story, Edith's Hook. It, you know, beginning with the damming of the Elwha River by Glynde's Canyon Dam and the Lake Mills dams. Those dams unfortunately interrupt sediment supply going to the ocean. And so you start to lose your natural beach nourishment when you interrupt the sand supply. And so we started getting rapid erosion to Edith's Hook. This was beginning back in the early part of the 1900s when the dams went in. Another problem has been the development along the beachfront. When people build bulkheads and riprap and revetments along beach areas, that can force these tidal rivers or longshore sand transport of sediments and cobbles and stones, and so they get pushed off into deeper water, and that accelerates the erosion. And areas like Edith's Hook now, it has a massive riprap on it just to keep it stabilized, and it requires artificial nourishment, trucks bringing in large amount of sands and gravels just to keep the place stabilized.
Because there's a Coast Guard station out there still, right?
There is. It's a fabulous place, actually, for coastal life-saving activities out there. It's ready access. It's a very protected harbor. But it has had its costs ecologically. There's a large runway put out there, and that has been problematic for the dune flora. But part of the Coast Guard's mandate is to monitor and restore activities, and they're quite keen to help out with restoration activities with other stakeholders, such as...
There's been a recent resurgence in interest in
absolutely
restoring that area, right?
Yep.
And that's what you've been involved with.
Yeah. Members of the Lower Elwha Tribe and the Clallam County Conservation District have been super helpful. There's also a fantastic blog if you're interested. Ian Miller, he is one of the, works for the University of Washington. Check out his blog. He writes extensively about our coastal safety and coastal zone management, and he's got some pretty cool observations of Edith's Hook. And so that's kind of really been great to see. There's been a number, just like here in Fort Warden, there's been several restoration efforts out there, primarily led by the tribes. And so it's highly accessible out there too. So get out there, and it's almost like you're on a boat when you're on Yuta's Hook, looking back at the land, beautiful views of the Olympic Mountains. And so we're happy to see restoration work going on out there.
Yeah, well, it's good to end with happy news. So thank you so much for coming out with us. And thank you, Meg, for being our recorder. And
my pleasure.
Thank you all for listening.
Super exciting, and I'm going to try to avoid the cactus and being a dispersal agent. Bye, everybody.
Bye.
And here's our mystery sound again. It's the sound of a surf scoter, most notably the sound of their distinctive wing whistle. In this recording, if you listen carefully, you can hear the sound of paddling feet. They are strong flyers, but need to gain momentum by running along the water first before they can get airborne. Surf scoters are large, stocky ducks and can be easily mistaken for puffins. The males are very flashy, with their large, sloping orange and white bills, white eye, and distinctive white patch on their forehead and on the back of their heads, against dramatic black plumage. The females are much more drab, more of a dark brown and showing the same bill shape, with faint white patches at the base of the bill and on the cheek. They nest on freshwater lakes and wetlands in the Arctic, but winter in open coastal environments, favoring shallow bays and estuaries with rocky substrates, and are one of the most common sea ducks seen in our area in the fall and spring. They forage almost exclusively by diving, taking prey from the ocean floor, and also taking mussels from man-made structures. Surf scoters used to be seen in our area in the non-breeding part of the year in large rafts on the ocean or in open bays and inlets, but their numbers have been on the decline, along with those of other species of scoters and sea ducks. The Sea Duck Society published a paper that white-winged scoters have declined by over 60% in the last 50 years due to a variety of causes. Their research team has found that the reasons for the decline seem to be threefold, including a decline in herring eggs, an increase in ocean contaminants, along with climate change affecting their nesting habitat. To read more details, go to seaducksociety.org. And look for the May 2021 newsletter. And that's it for Nature Now this second week of July. Thanks so much to Fred Sharp for being our guide to the dunes, to Meg Amos for being our field recorder, to Nora Petrich for being our sound editor, and to all of you for listening. As always, wishing you happy trails.
Dungeness River Nature Center is pleased to support KPTZ programming like Nature Now. In memory of Dee and Beverly Swearingen, who taught their children and grandchildren the love and stewardship of nature, Dungeness River Nature Center, teaching generations about nature on the Olympic Peninsula at Railroad Bridge Park in Squim. More at DungenessRiverCenter.org.